a fire in the winter, music on the phonograph, and Florrie with all of her eccentricities and animals. But she was such a large presence that the walls closed in quickly. They settled into their old bedrooms and went about the impossible task of trying to breathe some life into their home. They opened the doors and windows in an effort to circulate fresh air. It was summer, and the heat and humidity suffocated the land. The phone rang constantly as all manner of strangers and friends called with kind words or ridiculous questions or meddlesome requests. They finally stopped answering it. There was a flood of mail, and they opened and read the letters. Most were from war veterans who said nice things about Pete, though few had known him personally. For a few days, Joel and Stella attempted to answer the letters with short notes, but soon grew weary of the task and realized it was futile. Their father was gone. Why respond to total strangers? The mail piled up in his abandoned study. A few kind souls from town brought out dishes and desserts, the usual ritual after a death. But when Joel and Stella realized that most of the visitors were only curious, they stopped going to the door. Reporters came and went, all looking for an angle or a quote, but they received nothing. One from a magazine hung around until Joel shooed him away with a shotgun. Nineveh was of no help. She was crushed by the death of her boss and couldn't stop crying. She busied herself in the mornings with half-hearted efforts at cooking and cleaning, but by noon, she was too exhausted to work. Stella usually sent her home midday, happy to have her out of the house. Each evening after supper and just before dark, as the heat broke, Joel and Stella walked the dirt trail to Old Sycamore and had a word with their father. They touched his tombstone, had a tear, said a prayer, and walked back toward the house, arm in arm and speaking softly and wondering what in the world had happened to their family. As the long days passed, they accepted the reality that they would never know why their father had killed Dexter Bell, just as they would never know why their mother had had such a devastating mental breakdown. They told themselves that they did not want to know. They wanted to escape this nightmare and get on with their lives, lives to be lived somewhere far away. Joel called the director at Whitfield for the third time and asked to visit his mother. The director promised to consult with her doctors and called back the following day with the news that a visit was not permissible. It was the third denial. And as with the first two, the reason was that she was not able to receive visitors. Nothing more was said, and the family speculated that Liza had been informed of Pete's death and had slid even deeper into her dark world. Before he died, Pete made no provision for the appointment of a successor guardian for his wife. Joel met with John Wilbanks and insisted that he ask the judge to appoint either him or Stella, but Wilbanks wanted some time to pass. This angered Joel, and he threatened to hire another lawyer to represent him and the interests of his mother. Under pressure, he proved to be quite an effective advocate, quick with his tongue and smart with his reasons. John Wilbanks was impressed enough to mention to his brother Russell that the kid might have a future in the courtroom. After 2 days of constant badgering, John relented and walked with Joel across the street to meet with Judge Abbott Rumbold, the ancient dictator of Chancery Court. For many years, Judge Rumbold had been doing whatever John Wilbanks asked him to do, and within an hour, Joel was appointed the new guardian of his mother's care. He obtained a certified copy of the new court order and immediately called Whitfield. On August 7th, 4 weeks after the death of their father, Joel and Stella drove south to see their mother for the first time in more than a year. Flory was ambivalent about tagging along, and Joel, the new man of the house, suggested that she wait until the next visit. Eventually, that was fine with Flory. The same guard they had confronted months earlier was waiting with a clipboard at the gate, but the paperwork seemed less cumbersome. Joel drove straight to Building 41 and, armed with his court order, marched inside to see Dr. Hilzebeck. The two had spoken by phone the day before, and everything was in order. The doctor was somewhat pleasant for a change, and after reviewing the edict from old Rumbold, he clasped his fingers together and asked how he might help. Stella went first. "We want to know what is wrong with our mother. What is her diagnosis? She's been here for more than a year, so surely you can tell us what's wrong with her." A tight smile, then, "Of course. Mrs. Banning is suffering from intense mental distress. The term nervous breakdown is not really a medical diagnosis, but it's used quite often to describe patients like your mother. She suffers from depression, anxiety, and acute stress. Her depression leaves her with no hope and thoughts of suicide and self-harm. Her anxiety is evidenced by high blood pressure, tense muscles, dizziness, and trembling. She suffers from insomnia one week and then sleeps for hours and hours the next week. She hallucinates, sees things that are not real, and often yells at night when she has nightmares. Her mood swings are extreme, but almost always on the dark side. If she has a good day, one in which she appears somewhat happy, it is almost always followed by 2 or 3 days of darkness. At times, she is virtually catatonic. She is paranoid and thinks someone is stalking her or that someone else is in the room. This often leads to panic attacks in which she is stricken with absolute fear and has trouble breathing. These usually pass within an hour or two. She eats little and refuses to take care of herself. Her hygiene is not good. She is not a cooperative patient, and in group therapy, she goes into total isolation. We were seeing a slight improvement before the murder of Dexter Bell, but that event proved to be catastrophic. Months passed, and she got better. Then your father was executed, and Liza regressed considerably." "Is that all?" Stella asked, wiping her eyes. "I'm sorry."
"Is she schizophrenic?" Joel asked.
"I don't think so. For the most part, she understands reality and does not engage in false beliefs, with the exception of an occasional bout of paranoia. She does not hear voices. It is difficult to determine how she would act in social settings since she has not been released from here. But no, I do not diagnose your mother as schizophrenic. Severely depressed, yes."
Stella said, 18 months ago, our mother was fine, or at least she certainly appeared to be. Now she's suffering from what sounds like a severe nervous breakdown. What happened, doctor? What caused this?"
Hilzebeck was shaking his head. "I don't know, but I agree with you in that it was something traumatic. From what I gather, Liza and the family managed to survive the news that your father was missing and presumed dead. His return was a joyous event, one that I'm sure brought great happiness, not severe depression. Something happened. But as I said, she is not very cooperative and refuses to go into her past. It's quite frustrating, really. And I fear that we may not be able to help her until she is willing to talk."
"So how is she being treated?" Joel asked.
"Counseling, therapy, a better diet, sunshine. We try and get her outside, but she usually refuses. Barring any more bad news, I think she will progress slowly. It's important that she sees you."
"What about medications?" Stella asked.
"In this business, there are always rumors of antipsychotic drugs in development, but they appear to be years away. When she's not sleeping or overly anxious, we give her barbiturates. Also, an occasional pill for high blood pressure."
There was a long pause as Joel and Stella absorbed the words they had been desperate to hear for so long. The words were not encouraging, but perhaps they were the beginning, or the end of the beginning. Joel asked, "Can you put her back together, Doctor? Is there a chance she can one day go home?" "I'm not sure home is a good place for her, Mr. Banning. From what I gather, it's a rather dark and somber place these days."
"You could say that," Stella said.
"I'm not sure your mother can handle more bad news at home."
"Nor can we," Stella mumbled.
Dr. Hilzebeck suddenly stood and said, "Let's go see Liza. Please, follow me." They marched down a long hall and stopped at a window. Below them in the distance was a grove of trees and a series of wide walkways around a small pond. Near a pretty gazebo, a lady sat in the shade, in a wheelchair, with a nurse close to her side. They seemed to be chatting.
"That's Liza," Hilzebeck said. "She knows you're coming, and she's eager to see you. You can exit through that door."
He nodded, and they backed away. Liza smiled when she saw them. She reached for Stella first and pulled her close, then did the same with Joel. The nurse smiled politely and disappeared around a corner. They maneuvered the wheelchair to a park bench and sat facing her. Joel held one hand, Stella the other. They had braced themselves for how terrible she might look, so they tried to appear unsurprised. Pale, extremely thin and gaunt, and with no makeup or lipstick or jewelry, nothing to remind them of the beautiful and vivacious woman they knew and loved. Her sandy-colored hair was graying and pulled back into a bun. She wore a thin white hospital gown, and her bare feet were exposed.
My babies,
she said over and over as she clutched their hands and tried to smile. Her eyes were so disturbing. Gone was their color and exuberance, replaced by a hollow, unblinking stare that, at first, did not meet their eyes. She cast her eyes down a few inches and seemed to be looking at their chests. Minutes passed as Liza mumbled about her babies while Joel and Stella patted her gently and tried to think of something to say. Assuming any conversation was good, Joel finally said, "Dr. Hilzebeck says you're doing great, Mom." She nodded and said softly,
"I guess. Some days are good. I just want to go home."
"And we're going to take you home, Mom. But not today. First, you're going to get well. You're going to eat better, get some sun, do whatever the doctors and nurses tell you. And then one day soon, we'll take you home."
"Will Pete be there?"
"Well, no, Mom. Dad will not be there. He's gone, Mom. I thought the doctors told you this."
"Yes, but I don't believe them."
"Well, you should believe him, because Dad is gone." Stella rose gently, kissed her mother on the top of her head, and walked behind the gazebo, where she sat on its steps and buried her face in her hands. "Thanks for nothing, sis," Joel thought to himself. He began a windy narrative about nothing, or at least nothing to do with the obvious fact that they were sitting in the garden of an asylum with their mother, who was mentally ill. He talked about Stella and her upcoming return to Hollands for her junior year, and her plans to land a job in New York. He talked about his own decision to enroll in law school. He was accepted at Vanderbilt and Ole Miss, but was thinking of taking a year off, maybe to travel. As he gabbed, Liza heard his words and lifted her eyes, as if soothed by his voice. She smiled and began to nod slightly. He wasn't sure about the law, and therefore might take a break from his studies. He and Stella had spent time in D.C. and enjoyed themselves, and he had met a friend there who owned a restaurant and had offered him a job. After a good cry, Stella returned and joined in the one-way conversation. She went on about her time as a nanny in Georgetown and her upcoming courses and her plans for the future. At times, Liza smiled and closed her eyes as if their voices were a pleasant narcotic. The clouds disappeared, and the midday sun beat down with a fury. They pushed her wheelchair to a shaded area under some trees. The nurse watched them, but kept her distance. During a lull, Liza whispered, "Keep talking." And they did. An orderly brought sandwiches and glasses of iced tea. They arranged their lunch on a picnic table and encouraged Liza to eat. She took a few bites of a sandwich, but showed little interest. She wanted to listen to their lovely young voices, and so they talked, tag-teaming, and always careful to keep their stories far away from Clanton. Long after lunch, Dr. Hilzebeck appeared and suggested that the patient needed some rest. He was delighted with the visit and asked if Joel and Stella could return the following day for another round. Of course they could. They kissed their mother goodbye, promised to be back soon, and drove to Jackson, where they found rooms at the stately Hotel Heidelberg in downtown. After checking in, they set out on a walk to the state capitol and back. But the heat and humidity were too much. They retreated to the coffee bar, asked the waiter about alcohol, and were directed to a speakeasy behind the hotel. There they ordered drinks and tried not to talk about their mother. They were tired of talking. Chapter 37. Because he did not have a license to practice law in Mississippi, Errol McLeish was required to associate local counsel for his carefully laid plans. He never considered hiring anyone from Clanton. All the good lawyers there were kin to the Wilbankses anyway. McLeish wanted a lawyer with an aggressive reputation who was well known in North Mississippi, but with no close ties to Ford County. He took his time, did his research, asked around, and finally selected a Tupelo lawyer named Birch Dunlap. The two met a month before Pete's execution and began laying the groundwork. Dunlap liked the case because it had the potential for press coverage, and at least, in his opinion, it would be an easy win. On August 12th, Dunlap, on behalf of his client Jackie Bell, filed a wrongful death suit against the estate of Pete Banning. The lawsuit set forth the facts as virtually everyone knew them and asked for $500,000 in damages. In an unexpected twist, it was filed in federal court in Oxford, not state court in Clanton. Jackie Bell claimed to now be a resident of Georgia and thus entitled to relief in federal court, where the jurors would be summoned from 30 counties and where sympathy for a convicted murderer would be difficult to find. Since Florrie was the executrix of the estate, papers had to be served upon her. She was in the backyard tending to her birds when Roy Lester appeared from nowhere with a look of deep concern.
"Bad news, Florrie," he said, tipping his hat.
He handed over a thick envelope and said,
"Looks like more legal trouble."
"What is it?" she asked, knowing full well that he and Nix and probably everybody at the jail had read whatever was in the envelope.
"A lawsuit filed by Jackie Bell over in federal court."
"Thanks for nothing."
"Would you sign right here?"
he asked, holding a sheet of paper and a pen.
"For what?"
"It says that you have been served with a lawsuit and you have it in your possession." She signed, thanked him, and took the papers inside. An hour later, she barged into John Wilbanks's office and charged up the stairs. She thrust the lawsuit at him and fell onto the sofa in tears. John lit a cigar as he calmly read the 3-page pleading.
No real surprise here, he said as he sat in a chair across from the sofa. It seems as though we've discussed this as a possibility.
$500,000?
An exaggeration. Just part of the business. Lawyers typically demand far more than they expect to receive.
But you can handle this, right, John? There's nothing to worry about.
Oh, I can handle it all right, in the sense that I can defend the lawsuit. But there is much to be concerned with, Flory. First, the facts, and they are fairly well established. Second, Birch Dunlap is a fine lawyer who knows what he's doing. Filing in federal court is a brilliant move, and frankly, one I didn't expect.
So you knew this was coming?
Flory, we discussed this months ago. Jackie Bell's husband was murdered, and the killer had assets, which is unheard of.
Well, I don't remember what we discussed, John, to be honest. My nerves have been shot to hell this past year, and my poor brain can't take much more. What are we supposed to do now?
Nothing for you. I'll defend the lawsuit, and we'll wait for more to come.
More?
Wouldn't surprise me.
They waited 2 days. Birch Dunlap filed his second lawsuit in the Chancery Court of Ford County and named as defendants Joel and Stella Banning. Errol MacLeish figured the two would soon be leaving to pursue their studies and decided to serve them with process before they left town. Roy Lester again drove out to the Banning farm and handed papers to Joel, Stella, and Flory. Being sued by a good lawyer was uncomfortable enough, but facing two lawsuits with little in the way of defenses was terrifying. The three defendants met with John and Russell Wilbanks, and while it was somewhat comforting to be in the presence of loyal friends who were fine lawyers, there was an unmistakable sense of uncertainty in the air. Could the Bannings really lose their land? Flory's, of course, was safe. But the deed to Joel and Stella was being attacked by a lawyer who knew what he was doing. It was clear that Pete had planned the murder, and in doing so, attempted to transfer his most valuable asset to his children in an effort to avoid the claims of judgment creditors. The Wilbanks brothers discussed what might happen in the months to come. They agreed that Dunlap would probably press hard for a trial on the wrongful death claim, and assuming he won, and frankly it was difficult to see how he could lose, then he would bring his judgment to the Chancery Court of Ford County and assault their land. Depending on who won and who lost in which trial, the litigation and appeals could drag on for years. Attorney's fees could be substantial. John Wilbanks promised a vigorous defense on all fronts, but his show of confidence was not altogether believable. They left his office in a depressed state, and on a whim, decided to drive to Memphis, to the Peabody, where they could drown their worries at the elegant bar, eat a fine meal, spend a carefree night, and get out of Ford County. Better burn some cash while they had it. Joel drove, perched like a chauffeur, alone up front, with the gals in the rear seat, and for several miles nothing was said until they crossed into Van Buren County. Stella broke the ice with,
I really don't want to go back to Hollins. Class is starting 3 weeks, and I cannot imagine walking into a classroom and trying to listen to a lecture on something as unimportant as Shakespeare when my father has just been executed and my poor mother is in a mental institution. Seriously? How can I be expected to study and learn?
So you're quitting college?
Flory asked. Not quitting, just taking a break.
And you, Joel?
I'm having the same thoughts. The first year of law school is a boot camp, and I'm just not up to it. I was leaning toward Vanderbilt, but now with money more of an issue, I was thinking about Ole Miss. Truth is, though, I can't see myself sitting in a classroom getting hammered by a bunch of crusty old law professors.
Interesting, Flory said. And with no classes and no jobs, what will the two of you be doing in the months to come?
sitting around the house and driving Nineveh crazy? Or perhaps you could help out in the fields and pick cotton with the Negroes. Buford can always use some extra hands. And if you get bored in the fields, you can always pull weeds and gather vegetables from the garden, so we'll have something to eat this winter. Amos will be happy to show you how to milk cows at 6 every morning. Nineveh would love to have you underfoot in her kitchen as she cooks and cans. And when you get bored on the farm, you can always venture into town where everyone you bump into will ask, "How you doing?" and pretend to be so sad about your father. Is that what you want?
Neither Joel nor Stella responded. Flory continued.
Here's the better plan. In 3 weeks, you're getting the hell out of here because you need to finish school before we lose all the money. Your father put me in charge of your education, so I'm writing the checks. If you don't finish school now, then you never will. So you have no choice but to go. Stella, you're going back to Hollins, and Joel, you're going to law school. I don't care where, just get away from here.
A few miles passed in silence as the finality of the decision sank in. Stella finally said,
"Well, on second thought, Hollins is not a bad place to hide these days."
Joel said, "If I go to law school, I'll probably go to Ole Miss. That way I can visit Mom on the weekends, and I can also hang around Wilbanks' office and help with the lawsuits."
"I'm sure he has things under control," Flory said. "We can afford Vanderbilt if that's what you want."
"No. 4 years there is enough. I need to branch out. Besides, there are more girls at Ole Miss."
"When did that become important?"
"Always."
"Well, I think it's time you got serious about a girl. You are, after all, 21 and a college graduate."
"Are you giving unsolicited advice on romance, Aunt Flory?"
"No, not really."
"Good. Just keep it to yourself." Before leaving for the fall, Joel and Stella made 3 more trips to Whitfield to sit with Liza. Dr. Hilzebeck encouraged this and assured them their visits helped immensely, though they certainly could not see any improvement. Liza's physical appearance remained unchanged. For one visit, she refused to leave her dark little room and said virtually nothing. For the other visits, she allowed them to roll her around the grounds in a wheelchair, looking for shade from the August heat. She smiled occasionally, but not often enough, said very little, and never strung together enough words for a complete sentence. So she listened as her children tag-teamed their way through the same long narratives. To break the monotony, Joel read articles from Time magazine and Stella read from the Saturday Evening Post. The visits were emotionally exhausting, and they said little driving the long way home. After 4 trips to Whitfield, they were becoming convinced that their mother would never leave. Early on September 3rd, Joel loaded his sister's luggage into the trunk of the family's 1939 Pontiac, and together they drove to the Pink Cottage for a farewell breakfast with Aunt Flory. Marietta stuffed them with biscuits and omelets and packed a lunch for the road. They left Flory in tears on the porch and hustled away. They stopped for a somber moment at Old Sycamore and said a prayer at their father's tombstone, then sped to the train station, where Stella almost missed the 9:40 to Memphis. They hugged each other, tried not to cry, and promised to keep in touch. When the train was out of sight, Joel got in the car, drove a lap around the square, then through the side streets, past the Methodist Church, and finally returned home. He packed his own bags, said goodbye to Nineveh and Amos, and drove an hour to Oxford, where law school was waiting. Through a friend of a friend, he had a lead on a tiny apartment near the square, above a widow's garage, a cheap place rented only to graduate students. The widow showed him a tiny 3-room flat, laid out the rules, which included no alcohol,
no parties, no gambling, and of course, no women, and said the rent was $100 cash for 4 months, September through December. Joel agreed to her rules, though he had no plans to follow them, and handed over the money. When she left, he unpacked his bags and boxes and arranged his clothing in a closet. After dark, he walked along North Lamar toward the courthouse in the distance. He lit a cigarette and smoked it as he strolled past stately old homes on shaded lots. Porches were filled with the post-supper gossip as the families and neighbors waited for the heat and humidity to break for the night. Though the students were back, the square was dead, and why wouldn't it be? There were no bars, clubs, lounges, dance halls, or even nice restaurants. Oxford was a small, dry town, and a long way from the bright lights of Nashville. Joel Banning felt a long way from everywhere. Chapter 38. The lawsuit was over a deadly collision between a sedan filled with a young family and a flat rail car loaded with several tons of pulpwood. It occurred late at night on a main highway between Tupelo and Memphis, at a crossing that, for reasons never to be known, had been built at the foot of a long hill, so that the traffic coming down the hill at night could not always see the trains until the last moment. To avoid collisions, and there had been several, the railroad installed red flashing lights on both sides, east and west, but did not splurge on gates that descended and actually blocked the highway. The flat car was the 11th in a long train of 60, with two engines and an old red caboose. The lawyers defending the railroad made much of the fact that any driver paying sufficient attention to the road could certainly see something as large as a flat rail car that was 80 feet long and stacked 15 feet high with timber. They passed around enlarged photos of the flat rail car and seemed confident in their proof. However, they were no match for the Honorable Birch Dunlap, attorney for the deceased family, both parents and two small children. In 2 days of trial, Mr. Dunlap attacked the men who designed the crossing, exposed the railroad's lousy safety record, proved that it had been warned that the crossing was dangerous, discredited two other drivers who claimed to be eyewitnesses, and presented the jury with his own set of enlarged photos that clearly revealed a severe lack of maintenance by the railroad. The jury agreed and awarded the family $60,000, a record verdict for federal court in North Mississippi. Sitting low in the back row, Joel Banning watched the trial from beginning to end and felt sick. Birch Dunlap was masterful in the courtroom and owned the jury from start to finish. He was at home, comfortable and relaxed, and thoroughly credible. He was meticulously prepared, smooth on his feet, and always two steps ahead of the witnesses and the defense lawyers. Now, he was coming after the Bannings and their land. Because Joel was watching the court's Oxford docket with a keen eye, he happened to notice the upcoming trial involving the railroad collision. Out of curiosity, he decided to skip classes and watch it. And then he wished he had not been so curious. After the verdict, Joel thought about calling Stella, but why ruin her day? He thought about calling Florrie, but her phone line was not private, and why bother? He needed someone to talk to, but in his first weeks of law school, he had remained reclusive and met few other students. He was detached, aloof, almost rude at times, and always on the defensive, because at any moment he expected some loudmouth to ask about his father. He could almost hear the whispers behind his back. 3 months after the fact, the wounds from the execution were still open and raw. Joel was certain that he was the only student in the history of Ole Miss whose family had suffered through the shame of such a spectacle. On October 9th, he skipped class and drove to a lake, where he sat under a tree and sipped bourbon from a flask. 1 year ago, his father had murdered Dexter Bell. Joel studied hard, but found the classes boring. On Saturdays, when the talk was of nothing but football, he drove to Whitfield to sit with his mother, or he drove home to check on Flory and look at the crops. Home had become an awful, empty place, with only Nineveh to talk to. But she, too, was depressed and moped around the kitchen with little to do. Hell, it seemed as if everybody was depressed. On most Friday afternoons, Joel stopped by John Wilbanks's office to discuss the family's legal troubles, or to hand over a brief or a memo he had polished off at law school. Wilbanks was impressed with young Joel, and had mentioned more than once that the firm could use some fresh talent in a few years. Joel was polite and said he had no idea where he wanted to live and practice law. The last place would be Clanton, he thought to himself. As the holidays approached, Flory began dropping hints about another road trip to New Orleans. However, her plans seemed to collapse almost as soon as she made them. Joel and Stella suspected the reason was money. With the family's finances so uncertain, they had noticed a few cutbacks here and there. The 1947 cotton crop was good, but not great, and with Pete gone, the picking had lacked some intensity and efficiency. Stella arrived home on December 21st, and that night they decorated a tree while carols played on the phonograph. And they were drinking, a bit more than usual. Bourbon for Joel and Stella, gin for Flory. Nothing for Marietta, who hid in the basement and was convinced they were all cracking up and going to hell. As gloomy as things were, they tried their best to find the holiday spirit, with small gifts and big meals and lots of music. The two lawsuits facing them and threatening their future were never discussed. On Christmas Day, they once again loaded into Flory's Lincoln and drove to Whitfield. A year earlier, they had made the trip only to be denied access to Liza. Those days were over now because Pete was certainly out of the way, and Joel was now his mother's legal guardian. They sat with her in one corner of a large activity room and gave her gifts and chocolates sent by Nineveh and Marietta. Liza smiled a lot and talked more and seemed to enjoy the attention. In every corner, there was a quiet little family doting on a loved one, a patient with pale skin and hollow cheeks. Some were ancient and appeared half dead. Others, like Liza, were much younger, but they seemed to be going nowhere too. Was this really her future? Would she ever be well enough to come home? Were they destined for decades of such pathetic visits? Though Dr. Hilzebeck maintained that he was pleased with her progress, they had seen little improvement in the past 4 months. She hadn't gained a pound, and the nurses kept her in a wheelchair so she wouldn't burn calories walking. She often went for long stretches of time without a word. Occasionally, her eyes had a sparkle, but it never lasted. Driving home, they discussed whether the trips to Whitfield were worth the trouble. After Christmas, the music stopped and the cold rains began. Making merry became a chore, and even the pink cottage with its eccentricities was enveloped in moodiness. Stella suddenly needed to return to Hollins to finish some vague projects. Flory spent more time in her room reading and listening to opera. To escape the gloom, Joel left a day early and returned to Oxford. When the law school opened, he eagerly checked his grades and was pleased with his first semester test scores. At the end of January, he found himself back in federal court as a representative of the family. A magistrate had scheduled a pretrial hearing, and all lawyers were present. Flory, as executrix of the estate of Pete Banning, was supposed to attend, but typically she called in sick with the flu. Besides, Joel was already in Oxford, and he could certainly handle things. Joel nervously sat at one table between John and Russell Wilbanks and kept an eye on Birch Dunlap and his associate at the other table. Just being in the same arena with Dunlap was terrifying. The magistrate covered the list of all potential witnesses at trial and wanted summaries of the testimony of each. The lawyers politely discussed exhibits, jury lists, the usual pretrial details. The magistrate studied his calendar and announced a trial date of February 24th, barely a month away. He then asked if there was any chance of settling the case without going to trial. The lawyers looked at each other, and it was obvious they had not yet reached that point. Birch Dunlap stood and said, "Well, Your Honor, I am always ready and willing to settle, on good terms, of course. As you are aware, we have another lawsuit pending in the Chancery Court of Ford County, in which we are attempting to set aside the conveyance by the deceased of his section of land to his children. This happened 3 weeks before the murder. We've had the land appraised." He picked up a binder and sort of waved it at the magistrate. "The land is worth $100 an acre, or about $65,000 total, and we firmly believe this land belongs in the estate of Pete Banning and is therefore subject to the claim of our client, Mrs. Jackie Bell. The home is appraised at $30,000, and there are other assets." John Wilbanks stood, smiling and shaking his head, as if Dunlap were an idiot. "Those figures are much too high, Your Honor, and I'm not prepared to argue over them. But any talk of settlement is premature. We expect to prevail in Ford County and protect the acreage, and who knows what the jury will do in this case. Let's allow the litigation to run its course. Then we can have this discussion." "It might be too late, Mr. Wilbanks," the magistrate said. Listening to Birch Dunlap so casually discuss land that had been purchased, cleared, and plowed by Joel's great-great-great-grandfather made his blood boil. How dare this gifted shyster toss around values of hard-gained assets and sums of someone else's money as if bidding at an auction or wagering in a card game? Did he really intend to somehow squeeze the Bannings for everything they owned? And how much of the loot would his sticky fingers steal? The lawyers swapped comments, but made no progress. The magistrate called the next item on his docket. Outside the courthouse, Joel and John Wilbanks walked around the square while Russell ducked into a diner. "We should at least discuss the possibility of settlement," Wilbanks said.
"Okay, I'm listening," Joel said.
"Dunlap is high with his numbers, but not outrageously so. We could offer them $20,000 in cash and see what happens. That's a lot of money, Joel."
"Damn sure is. Where would we find that much?"
"There's about $15,000 in cash in the estate. You and Stella could mortgage the land. My family owns the bank, remember. I'm sure I can arrange a small loan."
"So you want to offer $20,000?
"Discuss it with Florey. I don't need to remind you that the facts are not with us in this case. Your father did what he did, and there's no excuse for it. The jury will be sympathetic to the Bell family, and sympathy is our enemy."
Chapter 39. Errol MacLeish scoffed at the suggestion that Jackie settles so cheaply. Nor would they consider $25,000. MacLeish wanted it all. The land, the house, the livestock, the people who worked there. And he had a plan to get it. Late in February, he and Jackie drove to Oxford and checked into a hotel on the square. Same room, though they were not yet married. The trial began on the morning of the 24th, Jackie, the plaintiff, sat with Dunlap and her lawyers and was attractive in solid black. Flory, on tranquilizers, sat between John and Russell Wilbanks, with Joel right behind her. When the opportunity had presented itself, Joel spoke to Jackie, shook her hand, and tried to be polite. She did not. She was the grieving widow, out for justice and revenge. Flory loathed her and never acknowledged her presence. As Judge Stratton went through the preliminaries with the 50 or so prospective jurors, Joel turned and faced them and the spectators. There were a few reporters in the front row. The doors opened, and much to his dismay, a class of third-year law students filed in with their professor. It was a federal procedure class, and since the trial had some notoriety, it needed to be studied. He noticed a few other law students in the crowd, watching intently. At that moment, he wished he had chosen another law school on a campus in another state. The morning was consumed with jury selection, and by noon, six had been selected and seated. A seventh would sit as the alternate. Since it was a civil case, four votes would be needed for a verdict. 3-3 would hang and cause a retrial. After lunch, Birch Dunlap walked to the podium in front of the jury box, straightened his fine silk tie, flashed a big smile, and welcomed the jurors to the center of justice. Joel watched every move, absorbed every word, and in his biased opinion, Dunlap was a bit sappy in his gratitude for the jurors' time and service, but he soon got down to business. He explained the facts and said liability was clear. It was a cold-blooded murder that led to a just execution of a man they would not meet. The real defendant was dead. Therefore, under the law, the plaintiff was forced to proceed against his estate. Much of the trial would revolve around the value of Dexter Bell's life, a value that could not really be measured. Dunlap suggested no amount. That would certainly come later. But he left no doubt that Reverend Bell was an extraordinary man, superb father, devoted pastor, and so on, and his life was worth a lot of money, even though he earned little as a preacher. As Dunlap spoke with great eloquence, Joel could almost feel the family's assets slipping away. Several times during his opening statement, Dunlap referred to Pete Banning as a wealthy farmer and a rich landowner. Each time Joel heard it, he flinched and glanced at the jurors. He and Stella had not been raised to believe their family was wealthy, and being described as such by a silver-tongued orator was discomfiting. The jurors, all middle class at most, seemed to be on board. Rich farmer murders poor preacher. The theme was established at the very beginning of the trial, and it would stick with the jurors until the end. John Wilbanks made a brief opening statement in which he asked the jurors if it was really fair to make the family of a man convicted of murder pay the price for his sins. Pete Banning's family had done nothing wrong, absolutely nothing. Through no fault of their own, his children had also lost a father. Why should they be punished? Hadn't the Banning family been punished enough? The lawsuit was nothing but a naked grab for the hard-earned money of a family that had toiled the soil for decades. Fine, honest, hard-working people who were not rich and were not wealthy and should not be subjected to such claims. In Joel's biased opinion, John Wilbanks did a splendid job of portraying the plaintiff as opportunistic and money-hungry. He was almost indignant when he sat down. The first witness was Jackie Bell, and just as she had done some 13 months earlier in Clanton, she took the stand in a very tight dress and was soon crying. As she described finding her dead husband, The jurors, all men, absorbed every word and seemed quite sympathetic. John Wilbanks passed on cross-examination. Nix Gridley was next. He laid out the crime scene as he had found it, produced the same enlarged photos of poor Dexter bleeding out, showed the jury the Colt 45 owned by the accused, and stated to a certainty that Pete Banning, a man he had known well, had indeed been executed in the electric chair. Nix witnessed the execution and had been present when the coroner pronounced Pete dead. After Nix was excused, Birch Dunlap entered into evidence, without objection, certified copies of the court orders finding Pete guilty of the first-degree murder of Dexter Bell, and the orders from the Supreme Court affirming his conviction. After the first long day of trial, it had been clearly established that Pete Banning murdered Dexter Bell and had paid with his life. Finally, thought Joel. While it was the same old jury news to him, it was riveting to the jurors. With causation established, the trial moved to the question of damages. At 9 Thursday morning, Jackie Bell returned to the witness stand and produced the family's tax returns for the years 1940 through 1945. At the time of his death, Dexter was being paid a salary of $2,400 a year by the Methodist Church of Clanton and had not received a raise since 1942. He had no other income, nor did she. The family lived in a parsonage provided at no cost by the church, with utilities included in the package. Obviously, the family lived frugally, but that was the life they had chosen, and they had been content with it. She was excused, and Dunlap called as an expert witness an economics professor from Ole Miss, one Dr. Potter. He held several degrees, had written a few books, and it was immediately apparent he knew more about money and finances than anyone else in the courtroom. John Wilbanks prodded with a few questions about his field of expertise, but was careful not to push too hard and get embarrassed. On direct from Birch Dunlap, Dr. Potter went through the history of Dexter Bell's earnings as a pastor, compared that history to the other ministers on similar paths, and crunched all manner of numbers. At the time of his death, at the age of 39, Dexter's total compensation was, in Potter's opinion, $3,300 per year, assuming a conservative annual rate of inflation of 2%, and assuming Dexter would work until he was 70 years old, which was the norm for ministers in 1948. Then his expected future lifetime earnings amounted to $106,000. Dunlap produced large color graphs and charts as he walked Dr. Potter through the numbers and managed to convey to the jurors that the money being discussed was real, hard cash that had been taken away from the Bell family because of Dexter's untimely death. On cross-examination, John Wilbanks hit Dr. Potter hard with some of his assumptions. Was it fair to assume Dexter would work until the age of 70? Fair to assume he would always be employed? Fair to assume a constant rate of inflation and unending pay raises? Fair to assume his wife would not remarry a husband who earned far more? Wilbanks cast some doubt and scored some points. But at least to Joel, he was attacking numbers that were so modest to begin with. Preachers earned little. Why make their meager salaries appear even less valuable? The next witness was a real estate appraiser from Tupelo. After establishing his qualifications, Dunlap asked him if he had appraised the Banning property. He said that indeed he had and offered a binder. John Wilbanks practically exploded and objected to further testimony. This skirmish was expected and had not been settled before the trial. Wilbanks argued strongly that the land did not belong to Pete Banning and was not to be included in his estate. Pete had gifted it to his children in much the same manner as his parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had handed it down. He produced certified copies of the deed to Joel and Stella. Dunlap roared back that the conveyance by Pete was fraudulent, and this upset Judge Stratton. He lectured Dunlap on using such prejudicial words as fraudulent when nothing had been proven. Wilbanks reminded the judge and Dunlap that there was another lawsuit pending in the Chancery Court of Ford County that dealt with the transfer of the land. Judge Stratton agreed and ruled that Dunlap could not attempt to prove that Pete Banning owned the land when he died. That matter had not been settled. It was a crucial win for the defense, and Dunlap apparently had miscalculated. However, he was an actor on stage and soon collected himself. After the appraiser left, he called Florey to the stand as an adverse witness. Wilbanks anticipated this and had tried to prep her for the ordeal. He assured her she would not be on the stand for long, but she was still a wreck. After a few preliminary questions, Dunlap asked her if she was the executrix of her brother's estate. Yes. And when was she appointed? Ignoring the stares of the jurors and locking in on the friendly face of her nephew, Florey explained that her brother Pete made a new will after he was sentenced to die. Dunlap presented a certified copy of the will and asked her to identify it, which she did. Dunlap said, "Thank you. Now, pursuant to the law and to the advice of Mr. Wilbanks here, have you filed an inventory of the assets and liabilities of the estate of Pete Banning?" "Yes." Wilbanks demanded that she keep her answer short. Dunlap picked up some more papers and handed them to Florey. He asked, "Do you recognize this as the inventory you filed in his estate in November of last year?"
"Yes."
"Once it's filed, it's public record, right?"
"I suppose. You're the lawyer."
"This is true. Now, Miss Banning, if you will, would you please look at the list of assets that you filed in this inventory, paragraph C, second page, and read them to the jury?"
"Why can't they just read it themselves?"
"Please, Miss Banning." Florey made a fuss out of adjusting her reading glasses, flipping a page, locating paragraph C, all performed in obvious frustration. Finally, she said,
"Well, number one is Pete's personal checking account at First State, balance of $1,800. Number two is his farm account, same bank, $5,300. Number three is his savings account, same bank, $7,100. Is that enough?"
"Please read on, Miss Banning," Dunlap replied patiently.
"A 1946 Ford pickup truck. Pete bought it new when he came home from the war. Approximate value of $750. I suppose you want to take that too."
"Please continue, Miss Banning."
"His car, a 1939 Pontiac, value of $600.
Joel shifted his weight as he pondered the loss of the car, one he had been driving since last summer. Florey went on to testify that the estate included two John Deere tractors, some trailers and plows, and other assorted items of farm equipment, all appraised at $9,000. It was indeed a farm complete with the usual collection of pigs, chickens, cows, goats, mules, and horses, and an auctioneer had placed a value on the animals of $3,000.
"Plus or minus a chicken or two," she said like a real smartass. "And that's all," she said, "unless you want his boots and underwear."
She explained that Pete owed no money when he died, and no claims had been registered against his estate.
"And what's the value of the Banning Mansion?" Dunlap asked loudly.
John Wilbanks bolted to his feet and growled,
"Objection, Your Honor.
The house is not separate from the land, and the land was deeded to the children. We just had this argument.
Indeed we did,
Judge Stratton said, obviously annoyed with Dunlap, who mumbled something like,